following program is furnished by its producer, host, and sponsors.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. We are live in the studios, and you're listening to Health in 30 on WRCR AM 1300 Radio Rockland and live online at WRCR.com. I'm your host, registered nurse Barbara Ficarra. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Raleigh Sullivan about opioid abuse, prescription drug abuse. Dr. Sullivan is a professor and vice chair of the Department of Behavioral Medicine and Psychiatry at West Virginia University School of Medicine. He serves as medical director of substance abuse programs for West Virginia University Hospitals. He's board certified in psychiatry, internal medicine, and addiction psychiatry, and is a fellow in the American College of Physicians. Dr. Sullivan directs the largest office-based opiate treatment clinic in West Virginia. Call in today with any questions for Dr. Sullivan to 845-624-1300. Hi, Dr. Sullivan. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Barbara. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, sure. When we think of drug abuse and addictive behaviors, we think of drugs that are abused, cocaine and marijuana, but actually prescription drug abuse is a big problem today. So actually, what is prescription drug abuse?
Well, you know, prescription drug abuse kind of snuck up on us, I think, in the national consciousness. What basically we're talking about are primarily the pain pills. In the mid-1990s, let me just sort of set the stage for this. In the mid-1990s, there was a movement in the United States that dictated that doctors really had been under-treating pain for a long time. And there were a lot of articles that came out in things like USA Today and Ladies Home Journal and a lot of journals that indicated that doctors had really been negligent in treating pain and that people were suffering unnecessarily. What happened was, towards the end of the 1990s, is there, because of that, because of this movement, number one, as you probably know, pain became a fifth vital sign. And at the same time, there was sort of a spectacular increase in the number of prescriptions written for these pain pills. And when I talk about pain pills, I'm primarily talking about the opioids, things like Oxycontin, Percodan, Percocet, Vicodin, Lortab, Lorset, Dilaudid, Morphine, Methadone. There's a lot of them. Codeine. There are a lot of them that are out there. And what occurred was there were a lot of prescriptions written for opioids. Some of those, unfortunately, you know, fell into the hands of people who began to misuse those, much the same way that we had seen heroin being used over the previous several decades.
With the opioids, are they more addictive or more involved in the whole process other than the stimulants, or are they in the same kind of class of being abused?
Well, no, the opioids are really, you know, kind of sedating, and they're very seductive, and most people find the opioids, well, it depends. You know, some people prefer the stimulants like cocaine or methamphetamine, but probably I would say a few more people prefer the good feeling from the euphoria they get from the opioids. But both of those drugs are very, you know, very seductive. And the truth of the matter is that some people prefer one, some prefer the other, and some people, you know, like to mix both of them together. That's an unfortunately common occurrence, and sometimes can lead to fatalities.
So name the opioids again. I know you went through them. There's OxyContin. And
yeah. Well, the opioids, a lot of people on the street call opioids narcotics, and let me just try to clear that up, because the word narcotic has gotten to be an incredibly poorly understood word. Narcotic, the word narcotic itself just means any drug that puts you to sleep. But, you know, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, lists things as narcotics, such things as, you know, marijuana and cocaine and LSD and a lot of drugs that don't have anything much in common, along with heroin. Unfortunately, in medicine, sometimes you'll hear people use the term narcotic, and what they usually mean is a powerful pain reliever. But the more appropriate term for these powerful pain relievers are really opioids. And the opioids can be naturally occurring, like opium, like morphine. Well, opium, if you chemically carve opium, what you get is morphine, codeine, both of which are very commonly used in medicine, and a third drug called thebaine. And thebaine is not ever used as a medicine itself, but oxycodone, which is the primary drug in OxyContin, mm-hmm. and Percodan and Percocet and Tylox and things like that, oxycodone actually comes from thebaine. So some of the opioids are really naturally occurring, like I said, morphine, codeine,
mm-hmm.
But some of them are made more in a laboratory, and I've just named oxycodone. Then you've got the hydrocodones, things like Loratabs, you know, Lorasets, Vicodin, and there's a whole lot of those. It turns out that the vast majority of prescriptions written for prescription opioids in the United States are written for the hydrocodones, primarily because they're a Schedule III. Now, that may not mean too much to you, but Schedule III means that you can write for refills. So for doctors, that mm-hmm. means they can see a patient every 3 months, and they can, you know, fill a prescription and then let the patient have a couple of refills, and they don't have to see them back quite as often. So it's a lot more convenient.
So how does it start, though, with the opioids? Is it a patient who's already addictive to something else beforehand, and then they end up maybe having some kind of pain, and then they go to their doctor, they get the prescription for the pain reliever, and they just become addictive to that because it's already within their behavior, or how does it work?
Well, that is certainly one scenario, and I see that all the time. We have a big inpatient, outpatient practice here, and a very, you know, this. First of all, let me again say something probably will be helpful to you as you think about this. You have to understand there's a baseline prevalence of addiction in the adults in the United States of about 15%, which means that there's about 15% of adults in the United States are prone to becoming alcoholic or drug addict. It's just genetically set up for it. Now, what happens is for some people, unfortunately, is that they get, you know, they'll get injured at some point,
mm-hmm.
and they'll go to the doctor, and if they're set up, you know, a lot of us, if we don't have addiction in our background, a lot of us will get injured, or we'll have a bad tooth, or, you know, there'll be some kind of surgery or something, we'll get put on opioids, and we don't particularly like the feeling of it, and, you know, in 3 or 4 days, we're wanting to get off of that stuff.
Right.
But some people, when they get started on it, they just start smiling. They think, oh, this is nice. And matter of fact, I need a little more of this. And then when they run out of that prescription, they go back and they tell the doctor, you know, I'm still having some pain here. I think we need another, you know, prescription or two.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing you know, the doctor, if they're not really careful, you know, now that they're treating some backache for 6 months or a year or 10 years, and, you know, the original problem is no, you know, whatever that was, whatever the problem was, is no longer the disease. The disease has become addiction and pain itself. It's no longer the fact they had a, you know, a bulging disc or a muscle
right.
strain or some kind of surgery. The problem becomes that they are now addicted, many of them, and they've got, you know, they've also got, you know, this, the pain is the disease.
So for the people, though, that are not with that addictive behavior, those 15%, is it possible, though, for other people who have no tendencies at all, though, to become addictive to that?
You know, that's a really good question, and it deserves two kinds of answers, because I get asked it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, producing addiction where there was no addiction before is really kind of uncommon. Let me give you the example.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a 75-year-old lady who, you know, breaks her shoulder, and you start her on OxyContin, it would be extreme, and she has no history of alcoholism or drug addiction. It would be extremely rare to find her 2 years later out on the streets panhandling for money to get OxyContin. You know, it just mm-hmm. doesn't happen like that. What occurs is that most of these people can't, you know, either they stay on stable doses or they can't wait to get off of it. Occasionally, and I've seen this, you know, not very often, but you do see it, where somebody with no history of alcoholism or drug addiction, they get started on one of these opioids, and 5 years later, they're buying them from their uncle, or they're buying them on the street, or they're stealing them, or they're working multiple doctors for prescriptions, or they're faking symptoms, you know, or they're getting drugs off the internet, or, you know, all sorts of things, and clearly they're, by then, a drug addict, when, in fact, if you look back in their history, there was no drug addiction. But let me tell you a more typical scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So that scenario does occur, that you can produce addiction where there was none.
Okay.
But it doesn't happen very often. What usually happens is, and we have to be careful with this, there's some people who have no history of addiction. They get started on you know, 4 Lorotabs a day, and 3 years later they're still taking 4 Lorotabs a day. Those people may be dependent upon the drug, but they may not be addicted to the drug. And there is a fundamental difference. In order to have addiction, you know, versus dependence. Dependence just means that if you take the drug away, they go into withdrawal. That doesn't necessarily mean they're addicted. That just means if you take the drug away, they go into withdrawal. And they may have, in fact, been using the medicine appropriately.
Wait, they go into withdrawal, though. That's not a good thing, though.
No, it's a terrible thing to go in withdrawal, but that doesn't mean they're an addict. In order to be addicted versus dependent, I mean, you know, diabetics get dependent upon insulin, you know. I mean, there's a lot of drugs that we can become dependent upon, but we're not addicted to. In order to have addiction, you have to do 2 things. You have to use the drugs in a non-prescribed fashion, and you have to be deceitful about it. You've got to lie about it. You've got to, you know, try to be sneaky and hide it. If you've got somebody who's lying about their drug use or being deceitful about it, and they're using their drugs in a non-prescribed fashion, then usually you have addiction. So you take this little 78-year-old lady who broke her shoulder, and, you know, 2 years later she's still on 3 Lorotabs a day. Now, she may be dependent upon the Lorotabs, but she's not addicted to the Lorotabs. She's merely physically dependent upon the Lorotabs.
So if you take that away from her, though, will she be craving it?
If you take that away from her, suddenly she will go into withdrawal because her body has adapted to it. But that's not the same as addiction. That's being merely dependent. And a lot of people mix that up. A lot of people get that confused. You know, and you hear people who are taking their drugs appropriately, family members will accuse them of being addicted to it. And that's not true. Addicts are sneaky and clever and, you know, deceitful and do things. You know, addicts are used to playing their own, they're used to being their own doctor. And, you know, patients will be very comfortable in letting their doctor tell them what to do and you try to follow that. And addicts don't do that at all. They want to be their own doctor. And so, you know, you'll see a big difference between somebody who's addicted to prescription opioids, and there are a lot of them, and somebody who's dependent to prescription opioids, and there are a lot of them, too.
Is that easy to pick up, to the difference between addiction and dependence?
No, you have to be. You really have to pay attention to the signs. It is not easy to pick up. As a matter of fact, it is a challenge that all doctors worry about, because one of the things that most physicians are aware of is that the patients sometimes are way better at doing what they do than the doctor is at what he or she does.
What do you mean?
What I mean is that the patients, I've had many, many patients. See, the problem is that most addicts don't look like what you think an archetype of an addict would look like. What they look like is oftentimes like you and me and everybody else. And you can't really tell. And I've had a lot of patients who tell me when they go into the doctor with the right kind of symptoms and the right kind of perfume on and the right kind of lipstick, and you know, with the right facial expressions, they are always successful in getting drugs. Always successful. And the doctors will look at them and think, okay, well, you know, that could be. They do seem to be like they're having a lot of pain, and she seems like such a nice woman. I remember this woman who is, I'm thinking about her now, she was about 56 or 57. She was a secretary, and, you know, just looked like just an average, you know, almost semi-middle-aged woman who worked in this law firm, very conscientious, and she'd been a drug addict for about 15 years and had worked so many doctors, and she had gone to so many emergency rooms, you know, and I actually took her to see the medical school, or the medical students, and she told them her story, and she said the most amazing thing is there was never one time she was not successful at getting drugs. She was always able to get drugs when she went in there because, you know, she didn't look like a drug addict. She just looked like a nice lady. And usually she usually got more than she'd asked for.
Oh, gosh. Now, do the doctors ever pick up on it where they would contact maybe their pharmacist to find out?
Sure.
Oh, they do. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Is that common?
Doctors worry about this all the time. You know, doctors worry that they're part of the problem rather than part of the solution. That, in fact, because they are gullible or naive, or that the patients are so good that they are actually becoming part of the problem. I was called actually yesterday by a pain doctor here in Morgantown, who I work closely with, who called me and told me about a patient who both he and I had been seeing, who'd been working 2 or 3 doctors here in town, and he'd gotten on the internet and gone to the West Virginia Board of Pharmacy. And West Virginia Board of Pharmacy, if you have clearance, you can get in and check anybody out and see what kind of drugs they're getting. And found that she, in fact, had been getting opioids from two or three doctors here in Morgantown simultaneously. And she's about a 55-year-old woman who just looks, mm-hmm. Just kind of like a normal person. We're not talking about somebody who's got 3 or 4 days and they haven't shaved and,
right.
dirty and greasy and mm-hmm. wearing a trench coat and kind of, look nasty. I mean, a lot of drug addicts look pretty much like everybody else.
Right. Now, when does a doctor, though, call and follow up on this? Is it just, how do they determine when they should follow up?
Well, part of it's suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is just suspicion. There are little clues that doctors can use to whether or not they think a patient's a drug addict. Now, let me give you a few clues, because I think this is important for people maybe to think about.
Mm-hmm.
One of the clues is if a patient comes in and asks for an opioid by name. If they come in and they're that savvy and they say, I've tried everything else, doctor. I've tried, drug X and drug Y and drug Z and,
mm-hmm.
All these Motrins and NSAIDs and all, aspirin and Tylenol, and I've been to physical therapy and, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the only thing that works is morphine, or the only thing that works is OxyContin. That should set off a huge red flag, because there are no chronic physical conditions in which the only thing that works
mm-hmm.
are those medicines. And, when somebody comes in, asks for a med and says that nothing else works, that should set off a red flag. Another one is, if they tell you, if all they want is symptom relief and they don't want treatment, that usually sets off a red flag. I just give me the pill and I'll be okay and I'll go on. If they're not willing to go get, physical therapy or to take NSAIDs,
mm-hmm.
which, things like Motrin or Naprosyn or even Tylenol, or if they're not willing to take other non-addicting medications, or
right.
they're not willing to, try an electrical stimulant, it depends on what their problem is. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do for people with pain. But if the only thing they want is symptom relief, and if you don't fix me, I'll just have to go see somebody who can. That kind of attitude.
Right. And then ultimately they probably end up getting their prescription, though, from someone.
Absolutely. And,
mm-hmm.
Because they threaten the docs or whatever. And, ultimately they will many times get their prescriptions. I am stunned. I almost hate saying this. I know you're up there in New York, but I am stunned up and down the East Coast by how much prescription drug addiction there is. Now, there's a lot of prescription drug dependence because, these things were prescribed, but there is so much prescription drug addiction
mm-hmm.
and trading. In our clinic, we have this big outpatient opioid clinic using a medicine called Suboxone. In our clinic, I think we have about between 150 and 200 people, and I have almost a 3-month waiting list now to get in.
Wow.
I mean, it is because there's so few doctors who do this kind of thing, and the need is so great. It's hard to, if you're an opioid drug addict, I'm like cocaine. Let's just
right.
back up a second. If you're
mm-hmm.
a cocaine addict
right.
and you really get into smoking crack cocaine, or if you get into sniffing powdered cocaine, you're going to do it for 2 or 3, 4 days. You may even do a lot of it and get really high and get,
mm-hmm.
stay up for 3 or 4 days and not eat. And then finally what happens, your system just collapses and you collapse and you go to sleep and you quit for a day or two. Which is why most people who do cocaine will go on these sort of runs, little short runs. Opioid addicts, once they get hooked on opioids, never take a day off. Never. And what happens is if they run out of opioids, they get incredibly sick. They call it getting dope sick.
Hmm.
And this is whether, I don't care whether it's heroin or codeine or Vicodin or Lortab, if they yeah. run out of opioids, they're going to get incredibly sick. So a prescription opioid or prescription drug addict's job
mm-hmm.
every single day when they get up is, where am I going to find drugs today? And then the hunt starts. And so they can't get anything else done. By the time I see them, and they've done this for months or typically years, they're in legal trouble, they're in horrible financial trouble, they're in terrible marital trouble and physical trouble, and they are just exhausted. Because they can't, they can't ever get anything done, because unless they have drugs, they're in withdrawal.
Right. That's what I was going to ask you. How do they get the treatment? They, I guess, hit rock bottom, and that's the last resort, is to get the treatment for it?
Well, yeah. People, addicts are no different. You know, I don't care whether it's a nicotine addict or an opioid addict. And by the way, I probably should throw that out there now, since I do alcoholism and drug addiction. Let us not forget that the most addicting drug known to man is nicotine, and we don't even begin to have time to talk about that. But I think it's very interesting. But what happens with opioid addicts is, and it's the same with alcoholics and nicotine addicts, what they all do, everybody does, if you have addiction, number one is you think you can treat yourself, and so you try.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody tries to quit on their own. And they don't just try once or twice, but they try lots and lots of times to quit on their own. Because mm-hmm. everybody gets up in the morning. I mean, this happens. A typical prescription opioid addict will get up in the morning and on one morning, and they'll say, I've had it, I'm tired, I spent another $300 on pills yesterday. And by the way, that's not uncommon. These people spend anywhere from $100 to $500 a day, typically. You know, they get up and then they say, you know, I've had it, you know, I'm a smart guy, I went to school, I deserve better than this, I am not going to do this anymore, you know, I'm tired of watching my kids go without, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I need to get a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have anything. I've pawned everything. I'm going to quit these drugs. They make themselves that solemn promise that morning. And, of course, by that night, they've been back out hunting drugs again, and they're right back in the same place they were.
Mm-hmm.
But they all try to quit. And sometimes, you know, addicts, I always ask this question. I ask them when they come to see me. I say, okay, how long? What's the longest you were ever able to make it without? And usually the answer will be like a day or 3 days at most. And by then they're just so sick and they just give up, and you know, and they're so vulnerable, and their brains, you know, you got to remember, an addict's brain is really changed. The disease of addiction is really a profound brain disease, and these people's brains are altered. And even though there's part of their brain that says, you know, you can do this, there's another part of their brain that's much more powerful, that says, no, I don't think so. I think you're going to stay an addict, and we're going to go out and find some pills right now. That's what happens. It's the same reason, you know, I'm jumping around a little bit, but it's the same reason everybody knows smoking's bad for you. Everybody knows smoking's bad for you, so why didn't everybody quit?
Right.
Does everybody love R.J. Reynolds that much? You know? No, I don't think so. The reason people don't quit is because they can't, because their addiction just
right.
won't let them, because they get so sick and they just can't stand it. It's a terrible brain disease.
Mm-hmm. So with the drugs, though, with these opioids, I know the doctors, you know, if they go to different doctors, they'll write the prescription. But how easy is it to get it off the Internet, though? Is that a big problem now?
Where the Internet, yeah. Well, it's funny. It is for Internet-savvy opioid addicts, it's no problem at all. I saw a nurse here recently who was getting them from three different sites. And she was typically taking Lortabs.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting enough, you probably know this, but Lortab is a combination of, and I'm not picking on Lortab, I'm not picking on any one of these. These are all great medicines in the right circumstances.
Right.
Just happens to be they're opioids. But she was getting Lortabs, which are 10 milligrams and associated with 500 milligrams of Tylenol. Lortab is a combination pill. And I forget how many she was getting a day, but I figured out she was taking 10,000 milligrams of Tylenol every day, in addition to all the opioids she was taking. And she was getting them from three different, she was a nurse, very savvy, very attractive nurse too. I was, you know, smart, and she was getting from three different Internet pharmacies, and didn't ever have to do anything except provide I shouldn't say this over the air, I suppose, but you know, she had to provide a very meager history in order to get the medications from the Internet. One of which was in the U.S., the other two of which were someplace else. I don't remember. I think one of them was in South America, and I forget where.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then they'd send her the pills in the mail.
Is there any kind of legislation going on, do you know, offhand about that, the Internet meds and stuff?
Well, you know, there is a little bit. I don't know very much about it, but a few years ago I was called, because of the big OxyContin epidemic later in West Virginia, I was called and went down to Congress, down to, they had a House subcommittee in Washington, D.C., looking at the problem of prescription opioid addiction. This was about 4 or 5 years ago. And I had to, you know, give my report to, there were four or five congressmen there. But I remember Asa Hutchinson was there. He was head of DEA at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about the fact that the DEA was really starting to hunt these sites and was trying to lock down on them, especially the ones in the U.S. But he was talking about how difficult it was, how they just kept popping up. These sort of, quote, pharmacies, unquote, you know, where in fact all it is somebody's got some, you know, they've got a computer and a bunch of pills stored in their garage, and how hard it was to, you know, really track all of them down.
Right.
So I don't. I mean, it's illegal to do this now. You're not supposed to be buying opioids over the internet without getting some sort of physical examination showing that there's a actual doctor-patient relationship that's ensuing,
right?
And that there's appropriate treatment, but still there's some scam stuff being done.
What about these kids though that are starting with all these non-prescription medications? Because isn't it a big problem with younger kids now too?
Yeah. Well, what's happened is it's real curious. We've been talking about this the past 2 or 3 months. When I first got into this business. Practically every, in the working with alcoholism and drug addiction in the early 80s, practically everybody I saw was alcoholic. And I would say that was probably 90% of my business. Probably 75% of my business now is opioid addiction, prescription opioid addiction. Alcoholism is much less. And it's curious what's happening. The patients who are coming to me are younger. Typically, when I first started out, I'd be getting people in their 30s through their 50s. Now I'm getting people in their 20s and 30s. And most of the time, it's opioid addiction. And what you're seeing when I ask them this question. I'll say, they're coming to me, they're hooked on opioids, and I'll say, when'd you start? And they said, started when I was 18 or 21 or something like that. And I'll say, well, do you drink? And they say, oh, no, I never drink, which is kind of common. Once you get on the opioids, on the powerful prescription pills, very few of these people drink very much or at all. I mean, some do drink a little, but very little. But then you ask them the next question, well, did you ever drink? And you'll find out that they go through a period of time, many of them do, when they're a teenager, when they're 17, 18, 19, 20, whatever, where they just drink alcoholically. I mean, just drank really, really heavy. And then at some point, somebody said, here, try some of these beans. These are really good. And so they'll try a few Vicodin or a Lortab or maybe even a fentanyl patch, which is especially dangerous. And once they get started on the opioids, they tend to leave the alcohol behind.
Right.
And so what I'm seeing is people who used to, when it was just booze, would take several years before they got addicted and really end up in treatment. Now I'm seeing a much shortening of that, and people are ending up in treatment at a much younger age because opioids are much more seductive and much more likely to end you treatment.
Go through some of the withdrawal symptoms, just so for the listeners out there that they can get a picture of kind of what goes on.
Yeah, well, if you run out of opioids, again, it doesn't matter whether it's heroin or one of the pills. What happens is that typically, the way I tell people, it's like having the worst case of the flu you can imagine. Your nose will run, you'll sweat, you'll get hot, you'll get cold. You may get terrible muscle aches, maybe all over your body. You may get nauseated. A lot of times people will get terrible diarrhea. And, this sense, and it just feels like, you're wet and clammy and, you're just sick, sick, sick. And it goes on for, not just for a few hours, but it can go on for a few days. If you're hooked on methadone, you could go on for, a couple, 3 weeks really trying to come off of that. And people just hate it because they feel so sick. So it's really like having, if you just want to sum up, it's like having a really, really bad case of the flu when you go into opioid withdrawal.
And then when you treat them with the Suboxone, is that what it is?
Yeah, Suboxone.
Do they get symptoms from that?
No, the Suboxone is, I've been doing this a long time. Truthfully, I thought opioid addiction, I got to be careful about saying this, I thought opioid addiction was almost a hopeless disease. I know the methadone's out there and has helped some people, but I have never had that much luck with it. And Suboxone came on the market a few years ago and can be used in a doctor's practice. You can be used in a private practice. And what it does, you can't get high on Suboxone, but what it does, it stabilizes the opioid receptors and allows people to feel normal. And if they can feel normal, then they can go about the business of trying to get clean and trying to get a job and trying to get, their relationships back and trying to get their life back on track. But you can't abuse Suboxone. You certainly can't get high on it. And I suppose you could sell it on the street, which might be an abuse form. But an individual can't abuse it because you're not going to get high on it.
Right.
But it does allow you, when you take Suboxone, it allows you to feel normal. I think it's just an absolutely terrific medicine.
Oh, I don't mean to cut you off, but quickly, like in 2 seconds, just sum up everything because the time is just running out. We'll have to actually have you back because there's so much to cover. Anything you want to just last quick words?
No, if it touched anybody out there, I hope that they go and they try to get themselves treatment. There is treatment available for those kind of opioids.
Thanks, Dr. Wally Sullivan. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your expertise with us. And there's some great websites. Go to healthin30.com and they'll be listed there. And next week, join us. Tune in on July 27th. Dr. Brian Doyle, psychiatrist, will join us to talk about adults with ADHD. He'll talk about his book, Understanding and Treating Adults with Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. Dr. Doyle is a clinical professor of psychiatry and family community medicine at Georgetown University Medical School in Washington, D.C. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I'm Barbara Ficarra for Health and 30. Have a great week.
AM 1300, WRCR, Spring Valley.
AP Radio News. I'm Ross Simpson.